Okay, so thank you. At this workshop, Lucien and I thought we'd each present some things, and I'm going to be summarizing a rather large body of work done over a number of years with my own research group and various collaborators, some of whom are in the audience here. One of the elephants in the room, I think, is this question: what happens when we put indefinite causal structure together with black holes? And I think the answer is nobody knows, including me. And I only have things to say around the periphery of this question. But ultimately, we need to come to grips with it, because these things, to the best of our knowledge, actually exist, and they change the causal of structures of space-time more radically than anything we know. They literally cut off regions of space and time. To the best of our knowledge, there are dark objects that, when smashed together, give gravity waves just the way Einstein's theory predicts. Do we really believe they have singularities at the core? Are they really causally ripping space and time apart in certain ways? I don't know. But I think we need to ask these questions. What we've been doing in my group, a large body of research, has to do with the quantum vacuum and its connection to black holes. So we've heard in this meeting already that causal structure is important in understanding particle interaction and decays, as John has pointed out. And we've heard a lot of talks about what it means to transfer information to signal or have indefinite signaling. And causal structure, as I already said, is very important when it comes to black holes. Black holes have around themselves a hot quantum vacuum, or in other words, they radiate particles due to the fact that, as far as we can tell, an event horizon literally rips apart pairs of quanta, one half going into the hole, the other half of an entangled pair going out to infinity, creating an information paradox, because as the black hole evaporates, these entangled quanta whose partners are in the black hole, the partners disappear and the radiation becomes entangled with nothing, whatever the heck that means. So I think we need to study the quantum vacuum, and it's been known for a long time this is a noisy place. It has a lot of field fluctuations and a lot of correlations. The question that we've already heard an answer to here: how do we probe it? And the answer is, operationally, we need detectors. The only way we can learn and practice about a vacuum is by probing it with something. So we have models of quantum detectors, and there are a variety of these things. I'll be talking mainly about qubits, but harmonic oscillators can be used. You can use Gaussian systems. And operationally, this is how we empirically learn about these various things right here. One might say this is the only way to actually learn about these things. We need some kind of operational probe. Now, the one commonly used, and that will be the focus of this talk, is the Unruh-DeWitt detector, which is basically a two-level atom with a ground and an excited state. And the formalism developed around quantum detectors, this paper was influential in doing it for the vacuum continuum, and there are a couple of other papers here where it was explicated for situations in cavities. But the three main things to remember, Laura talked about this in her talk: we have a detector piece, how the qubit interacts, its kinetic energy and its gap potential, I guess. It's the quantum field, which we can take to be a lot of things, but in this talk, it'll basically be a free scalar field. And we have the interaction between the detector and the field, which at the vacuum case is this linear interaction. Or if we go to a cavity, it's easier to express these things in Hamiltonian language. Again, it's a linear type interaction. This is the field expanded. This is the qubit or the detector right there. So here's that action again, just so you don't have to remember what it is. And the way this formalism works is we need to be able to turn the detector on and off using something called a switching function, which is commonly, but not necessarily, a Gaussian, and I won't always be using one. And likewise, we have a monopole detector that raises the ground state to an excited state, or changes the excited state to a ground state. And upon time evolving this system unitarily, perturbatively in this coupling, lambda d, one for each detector, if we have two detectors, we get this density matrix once we trace over the field if we place everything in the ground state. And it has this X kind of shape here. Perturbatively, the lower right term is of order lambda to the fourth, and so it can be neglected. But it has three basic pieces. And it has local excitations described by P, the basically sensitive to the noise of the vacuum. It has local correlations, the correlations of everything. The interesting thing for entanglement are the non-local correlations expressed by these quantities, given by this thing called the Whiteman function. This is the part that cares about how the field knows about space and time. This is, in some sense, the link between the operational aspect of the problem and the fundamental physics aspect, right up there. If the field is hot, or if we're in a system at finite temperature, the Whiteman function obeys this relation, where T is called the KMS, Kubo-Martin-Schwinger temperature. There's another kind of temperature I'll be talking about as well, namely, that's what our thermometer tells us, the detector. It's excitation ratio. TEDR, the excitation detector ratio, is the ratio of the probability that you excite with positive gap versus the other way around, maybe de-excitation with positive gap or excite from negative gap. There's one other quantity that's relevant as well, the concurrence, which, although as a more complicated formula, is basically the difference between the magnitude of the non-local correlations and the root mean square of the noise of each of the detectors. And it monotonically increases with the entanglement of formation, as Laura pointed out in her talk earlier this week. So causal cheats, what are they? Well, we're cut off by black holes or by horizons in space and time, and this either cheats us out of learning something, or conversely, perhaps we can cheat this causal disconnectivity and learn other things, and we'll see both of this in this talk. Now, I called this unfamiliar Unruh effects, but the Unruh effect, namely that temperature is proportional to the acceleration of a uniformly accelerated detector, has been known for a long time. A cold vacuum to one observer is a hot vacuum to another, namely a uniformly accelerated one. And likewise, quantum entanglement between one pair of observers is degraded entanglement to another pair. That was pointed out by myself and Yvette Fuentes and Paul Alsing and Trace Tessier in these papers here. The point I want to make is this effect originally and for many years was concerned with a causally inaccessible region with an eternally accelerating detector. Now, this is a significant idealization. No detector can accelerate for eternity in practice, and certainly not uniformly. It's impossible in practice. We all know this. So how necessary is this idealization? Will accelerated detectors get hot or not? And there are a number of things that can come in here. Some people have said that the Unruh effect is real enough to roast a steak. Well, is it? I don't leave my oven on forever to roast a steak. So I looked at this problem with Shiyun Lin, Baylock Hu, and Jason Dukas. And what we were interested in were oscillating detectors. In a lab, you might be able to accelerate a detector back and forth, like a harmonic, not that the detector's a harmonic oscillator, but the motion is harmonic. And there's a formalism developed by Baylock and Shiyun where the uncertainty function can give you a measure of an effective temperature in this system based on the covariance matrix of the canonical position and canonical momentum of the detector. And we looked at three kinds of motions, all of which are periodic in space. This is space versus time, but their accelerations are quite different. One is sinusoidal motion, an actual sinusoid, the green curve. The acceleration relativistically is this green curve. Another is actual sinusoidal acceleration. That's the red curve, which gives the red spatial curve here. And a third one is uniform back and forth, Constant this way, same constant that way. Constant this way, same constant that way. And we asked, what will the temperature of these things become if you wait a while? And the answer is this. The colors, unfortunately, don't match, but this is sinusoidal acceleration, sinusoidal motion, and alternating uniform. They're all the at late time average temperature, based on that measure, they're all growing as the acceleration increases. But they're not growing like a over 2 pi. Now, of course, that's not terribly surprising. We are losing the idealization. These are parameters we set for these various graphs that depend on how you actually compute the integrals that I don't want to go into. This is basically a close-up of this, is a graph of temperature divided by A bar versus the gap of the detector. If it were a pure Unruh effect, you'd get this horizontal line. We clearly do not. Now, accelerated detectors get hot, but not like A over 2 pi. Another thing that I looked at with Eduardo Martin Martinez and a former student, Wilson Brenna, and also considered in this paper here with Anjay and Alex and some others, is a detector in a cavity using this formalism here that has these advantages that you can smooth out switching effects. So the idea is you send this thing through a cavity, and we ask, will the detector thermalize? Is temperature proportional to acceleration? How sensitive is this to boundary conditions? And the result of that was basically this. For periodic Neumann or Dirichlet conditions in the cavity, it's hard to distinguish these curves, but you could argue it doesn't really matter because they're all pretty much the same curve, showing that temperature is proportional to acceleration using normalized units, but the coefficient is not A over 2 pi. So temperature is like acceleration, is like gravity, but the slope is wrong, or wrong isn't quite the right word. It's different from what one might expect. So we looked at smaller accelerations. Actually, you see this graph. There was a bit of deviation there. So we thought, let's push this graph this way and see what happens. And we found something I thought quite surprising. Namely, there is certainly a regime when we had this gap where at large enough gap, the excitation increased with acceleration. But we also found this blue curve for a smaller gap where the excitation decreased with increasing acceleration. And we called this the anti-Unruh effect. It's going backwards. The detector is getting colder as it accelerates more. Now, eventually, if you push the acceleration higher, this goes up, which I'm not showing on the screen. We plotted out the temperature gradient. In other words, the rate of change of temperature with respect to acceleration. And the red regime is where this is positive, and that's an Unruh type effect. But the blue one below that dashed line is where it's negative, and that's an anti-Unruh effect. Eduardo and Luis Garay and Jose Ramon looked at this in this other paper and found this is not a transient effect. This can happen quite robustly depending on the parameters you set. And in particular, they looked at this thing I said before, the ratio of excitation to de-excitation for the detector, from which you can compute an effective detector temperature. That's how the UDW detector is a thermometer. And they found there were but then the question is, how does it compare to the field temperature defined by Kubo, Martin, and Schwinger? And they found there were actually two kinds of effects. One is the weak anti-Unruh effect shown here, where this derivative is negative. And it can persist for long times. Basically, the detector clicks less often as it accelerates more. The other is the strong effect, whereas the field temperature goes up, the EDR temperature goes down, and that's called the strong anti-Unruh effect. So that's a bit of a surprise, at least it was to me, and I think it's at least a lesson that we better be careful by what we mean by temperature. Here's another cheat. The anti-Hawking effect, which is a paper put out recently that I'll tell you about in a minute. As a prelude, Yorma Luko is one of the people that has pushed forward very much the idea of asking how detectors respond outside of black holes, And I also did some work with him and Eduardo and now former student Keith Eng and Lee Hodgkinson, looking at these various black holes using this detector formalism. The key quantity of interest is this response function F and its rate of change. And I don't have time to go through all the arithmetic, but that detector response rate, Yorma Lee and Adrian Ottewell plotted, and for negative gaps, which means the detector starts excited, as the energy as the gap of the detector over temperature goes down, you get this oscillating decreasing effect. If I zoom in on here, there is a non-zero temperature for various kinds of vacua outside these black holes. The effects are further suppressed if you put the detector far away at 40 Schwarzschild, well, I guess 20 Schwarzschild radii relative to 2 away from the black hole. We looked at this for Schwarzschild ADS and discovered you can learn what I think are interesting things. Namely, when we looked at similar quantities, we found that there were spikes in this decay rate, and at first they thought they were puzzling, but then we realized these spikes are correlated with the quasi-normal modes of the black hole because of the scalar field. In other words, the detector is telling us the quasi-normal mode structure of the black hole. It's providing empirical information about this, again, underscoring the notion if you want to learn about the vacuum, you got to probe it with something. So what about this anti-Hawking effect? This we put out last month. The idea is to take a detector in ADS Rindler space, which basically means pure ADS, but you've got an eternally accelerating detector. It zooms in from infinity and zooms out again at constant acceleration. In a Penrose diagram, that would be its world line, and here's the ADS metric written in these coordinates where x varies over all values. Now, there's a paper by Jennings that showed, yeah, this thing gets hot, but only if the acceleration is larger than the inverse ADS length. Otherwise, it does not excite. I find it's curious, this is in 2010, this could have been done 20 years earlier. I think it showed a bias of the community to only look at the flat space Unruh effect. Here it is, but it ain't just A over 2 pi.
Is it David Jennings?
I think it, yeah. So what Laura and Alex and Roby Henegar and Johnny Zhang and I did in this paper was compute the response function in ADS Rindler space. Here it is, just to prove to you we did the arithmetic, and this is what it looks like. When we have the width of the detector go to infinity, which means it's basically always on, and we found this graph. You might say, what's the big deal? As the temperature goes up, which is determined by where this detector is. So we're in ADS, and we put it at different fixed locations relative to the origin in those coordinates. And we find excitation rate increases as a function of temperature, except right there. There is a weak anti-Unruh effect when you have Neumann boundary conditions, which is what those are in ADS. Well, how do you do it for a black hole? Well, the easiest way is to turn ADS into a black hole, which is what you have in the BTZ case. And there's a layer of mathematics about that. But the key point is you have exactly the same metric, except X is no longer over all the real numbers. It's periodically identified. And you have a freedom to choose that constant to be negative. And the value of that negative constant is the mass of the black hole. And you can show by all kinds of standard methods that this thing has a Hawking temperature that's like the square root of L squared m over 2 pi. So suppose we put a static detector there. This would be its world line outside of the event horizon. It will have a Jennings type of temperature for exactly the same reason. That'll be the local KMS temperature of this thing. Now, the Whiteman function is different from ADS3. Because of this periodic identification, the Whiteman function is a sum over images of the standard ADS function. And what we found were these two graphs right there for these three Dirichlet transparent and Neumann boundary conditions. And you can see from the slopes, well, let me put this up here, we have both a weak and a strong effect. And we call this the anti-Hawking effect because it's Hawking radiation. In other words, the dP by dT is negative for all three boundary conditions. Even this one, if you zoom in there, it's a little bit negative for a little while in Dirichlet. Not long, but long enough. Likewise, the EDR temperature does not correlate with the KNS temperature. It decreases. Eventually, it does become the same. So over here, you've got a good thermometer, but over here, you don't. It's not good at measuring cold temperatures. And it's a small mass effect. The smaller the mass of the BTZ black hole, the more pronounced this effect is. That's basically because the identifications matter more and more. The image sum needs more and more terms to converge. Cheat number three, looking inside black holes. This is something Alex and I did a while ago. You can take a BTZ black hole and make a topological identification to turn it into a gion. Basically, that's like making the center of the black hole into a Klein bottle. So you no longer have, oopsie-daisy, the other side of the Penrose diagram here. And we asked, well, is the detector response any different here than there? The Hawking temperature is the same, and in principle, if you don't go outside, if you don't go inside the event horizon, you have no way of knowing if you're outside a gion or outside a black hole. Keifeng and I looked at this with Eduardo for a Schwarzschild case. You get the same kind of identifications, turn the usual Penrose diagram into this. The difference is the Whiteman function is now a sum over modes. So we have two very different methods. One is sum over images, the other is sum over modes. But this graph, this slide shows you, you basically get the same thing. You find that the BTZ rate, which would be flat as a function of time, is very different from the gion rate, which oscillates if you wait long enough. We have lost full-time dependence. There's an indefinite sign of the killing vector at the origin because of this identification. So we've sort of cheated here. We've maybe taken a teeny-weeny peek inside of a black hole in both of these cases. Cheat number four, the entangling power of anti-de Sitter space, or de Sitter space, and I'll talk about that one first. Gibbons and Hawking pointed out way back when, 1979, you put a detector in de Sitter space at some temperature, put it in an oven at the same temperature, you cannot learn whether you're in an oven or in de Sitter space from the response of the detector. However, Nick Menicucci and Greg Versteeg pointed out 10 years ago that if you had two detectors, you can tell the difference. So the idea is this. This is the temperature of de Sitter space due to the cosmological horizon. If you put two detectors there, the cosmic expansion will pull them apart. But you could imagine an observer in the middle getting signals from each, and he or she could learn about the correlations between those two things. And the point is that how they entangle in a heat bath is not the same as how they entangle in this situation. Nick and Grant Salton and I looked at this in more detail here in this paper. We looked at detectors accelerating in parallel or in anti-parallel. We found, curiously enough, the parallel case was like de Sitter. What does this graph mean? This is energy gap on the vertical axis versus the ADS length in normalized units of a constant parameter kappa. You can't harvest if you're too far apart and don't have enough gap. If you were in thermal Minkowski, you could get entanglement here, but if you're in de Sitter of parallel acceleration, you have a smaller entanglement region, which is the point. If they're anti-parallel, then you've got zero negativity here, and you've got a dead zone right there, which will reemerge in a short while. The key point of this is we learn things about from two detectors that we cannot learn from just one. The entanglement properties are telling us something we didn't know. So this process came to be called entanglement harvesting, and there's quite a number of papers that look at it by different people in this room, and it's been given a number of in-principle applications that I don't have time to go into. My interest has been more here. We don't know very much about how to extract vacuum entanglement when space-time is curved. In flat space-time, Eduardo and Poses-Kirstens did a fairly thorough study to see just exactly what properties are involved here. If the detectors are too far apart, you lose entanglement, and eventually you don't get any. You can get more if you let the gap grow bigger, because noise, it's harder to excite a detector noise-wise if it has a bigger gap. There's a weak dependence on the number of dimensions of space-time, but as pointed out long ago by Antony Valentini, you can, in principle, harvest entanglement even if the detectors are always space-like separated for the time that they are on. And these other papers here, one by Alex and Danny Turno and Eduardo, looked at flat space-time in other contexts. I don't have time to talk about that. What we did is look at, Laura, Roby, Alex, and Johnny and I, looked at what happens if you harvest entanglement outside a black hole. And we went back to the BDZ black hole because the Whiteman function is a sum over images. So here's that metric again. And the idea is you take two detectors, put them at various fixed proper separations, and then here's the black hole. You move them around like this, and you see what happens to the entanglement. And we found a number of results. To set them in context, we also looked at ADS space in these two papers. So the idea here is you wait a while the detectors are on in anti-de Sitter space, and at some fixed, various fixed separations. So here it is, one detector's here, the other is there. Here's the Whiteman function, depending on the proper length, the proper separation of the detectors, given in terms of the coordinate separation and the ADS length. We look at all the boundary conditions. We looked at this thoroughly. And we found a number of things, but one of the curious features is as we changed the ratio of the ADS length to the effective time the detector is on, we discovered this little thing right here. Black means you can't harvest. Red means you get a lot of entanglement. This, you get a tiny bit of entanglement. But we found this little thing right here, which is an island of separability. For some reason, for a certain range of gap and separation, you kill off entanglement entirely. We don't entirely understand why, but we do see the concurrence drops to zero in this region right here, not because the noise is changing, but there's this dead zone of, near dead zone of correlation. The correlations drop and then they revive again. This was seen for all boundary conditions. Well, the same kind of thing happens for a black hole, but it happens right around the black hole. Black holes inhibit entanglement. If you put these detectors too close, static but too close, you can't extract entanglement from the vacuum. And the reason is there is a competition between the local excitations and that increase. The black hole is effectively hotter as you get near it, but decreasing non-local correlation. But it's not always straightforward. Sometimes it happens because, not because the excitations are getting bigger, but rather because the correlations plunge down and become small near the horizon. Other times, it is because the excitation of the nearby detector A goes way up. The correlations drop, but not as much. The lighter the mass for the BTZ black hole, the more pronounced this effect is, by which I mean the dead zone tends to move out. So here, the concurrence is non-zero, but it drops to zero close by for heavy mass, farther away for 1 over 100, even farther for 1 over, I guess that's 10,000. What about the angular dependence? Well, you not only can do this with the detectors, you can also do that with detectors and ask if there is angular dependence. We did that, and the answer is yes, there is. Here, we have one detector nearby, the other separated at 32 time with separations. So far away from the black hole, red means you can harvest, black means you cannot harvest. And if you want to see this in a graph versus angle, you get a peak. That's what this red thing is. So you get lots here and it falls off near the edges, and then you get nothing if you're at too wide an angle. So black holes have an entanglement shadow that looks like this. If you want to harvest near a black hole, a BTZ one anyway, you can harvest here, but not there. I think there's more physics to be learned from this, but it does tell us what we can and cannot learn from the quantum vacuum. Okay. Laura and former undergrad Suyu Ding and I are have looked at entanglement in the Gion case I talked about earlier. The Gion shadow is larger than its black hole counterpart. The effect is more prominent for smaller mass. I'm not going to say more about that, but it does show that the entanglement is sensitive to the topology of the space-time. Not unexpected, given the earlier results. Cheat number six, the equivalence principle. Suppose you wake up one day and you're floating in space. How do you know you haven't been abandoned in the wide, empty universe, or that aliens have trapped you inside a Dyson sphere? How would you ever learn? Well, you could send a signal out, and if it bounced back, you'd know you were in a Dyson sphere, but you'd have to wait. Can an astronaut determine this? Space is flat inside both places. Can they determine it if the shell is rotating? Well, classically, you can't unless you can interact with the shell. But quantum mechanically, you can with a UDW detector, and that's the lesson from this paper right here. And here are the answers. If you look at the relative response of a detector, shell response minus flat response divided by flat space response, you get something non-zero for positive gap. For negative gap, you can't see anything. And here is a different way of expressing these kinds of things. We have some work in progress for a rotating shell that we're still trying to sort out. This is Juan Kong, Jiri Bishak, David Kubiznak, and I. If you offset the detector from the center of the sphere, you likewise detect the inertial frame dragging, but it's an effect only of order A squared, not of order A for the shell. Cheat number seven, mirrors. This is with Juan and Erickson Choa, two PhD students of mine, and me in a paper that's now in JHEP. This is the first study of harvesting with moving boundary conditions. Again, way back in Burrell and Davies, one detector outside a mirror is studied. What about two? Well, we found there is both entanglement inhibition and entanglement enhancement near a mirror. Why does this matter? Well, in some sense, a moving mirror can model gravitational collapse. If it asymptotes to the speed of light, you go from a region where you've got causal connectivity to one where it goes away. So we think that's a necessary prelude to that. So that's what this means. This is, the idea is this is a rocket moving a mirror and the detector's in the mirror. That's my way of doing a cartoon. And we looked at both standard coupling and derivative coupling. And we looked at three kinds of mirrors. One is the static mirror in blue. Another is called a Carlitz-Willy mirror. And another is the black hole collapse mirror. Why that? Well, this one, it turns out, has a radiation flux, just like an eternal black hole. This one has the same Bogle-Obloff coefficients as the collapse of a null shockwave. So they sort of mirror these two kinds of black holes. This one an eternal black hole, this one a collapsing black hole. Here's the Whiteman function for this thing in case you don't believe we did arithmetic. So of course you get distortion of the concurrence as a function of detector separation and of when both detectors are turned on. Turn this one on now, a bit later, or vice versa. That's what that means. So again, color you can harvest, blue you can't. So you get, we do this for varying separations. As B goes farther away, the concurrence drops eventually to zero. But if you get the other guy too close, it drops rapidly to zero as you approach the mirror. Here is how we can compare the two to the Carlitz-Willy case. they don't look a whole lot different, but there are some notably distinct features. I just want to point out this graph because in certain cases we found from the Karlitz-Wille mirror that you get entanglement enhancement as both detectors at the same separation are farther from the mirror. More entanglement than you would if they were just in free space. It's not as much if you have a 3-sigma separation as you do a 2. What about black hole collapse? Again, the mirror models the black hole. We have a death zone, but we also have a small enhancement region above the flat space case, depending on what the parameters are, whether we switch on the detectors early relative to the collapse or late relative to the collapse. Well, that's mostly what I had to say. I think if we want to cheat causal order, we shouldn't cheat and be honest and say, let's make it actually indefinite. And this is what Laura talked about in her talk earlier this week. So I'm not going to repeat the entire talk she gave. This is work with Esteban and Chaslov and Alessio and Constantino and Magdalena Zeik. But we are implementing in this program the causal switch. So we have the same perturbative and non-perturbative, I've written the perturbative one here, reduced density matrix for the two detectors with a causal switch. And as Laura pointed out, we are finding that if we superpose detector A turned on before B with B turned on before A, relative to turning them on once, turning them on again, we can harvest not only more entanglement, but entanglement in regions that is otherwise impossible. So the key lessons here, entanglement harvesting operationally probes the entangling capacity of space-time. We have a lot of interesting features in curved space-time we're still uncovering. It's similar to flat space in a number of ways, depending on gap and separation. But when there's a curvature scale nearby comparable to the switching width, we get interesting effects like separability islands. Black holes, at least in the 2+1 case, inhibit entanglement. We need to see if that's a generic feature of black holes. We suspect it is, but we do not have clear demonstration of that yet. Moving mirrors, I think there are interesting things to be learned. We have both inhibition and enhancement features, and we're working on indefinite causal order, which seems to enhance the harvesting capacity of what these detectors can do. Thank you.
So I think we have 5-10 minutes yeah. for questions.
Thanks, Rob. You're shooting with interesting results like a machine gun.
I've got more if you want.
I have some questions about the anti-UNRU, anti-hogging effect. Mm-hmm. You define some types of temperatures, KMS and EDUR and others, and they don't seem to lead to consistent results. You have different results for one type of temperature, slightly different for others. They are not exactly the same, mm-hmm. and which may point out that the very definition of temperature may just break down in some of the regimes you're using. So for KMS, for instance, what needs to be satisfied is the KMS condition.
We've checked that. That works. In all the regimes where you get this opposing effect, those conditions hold.
So how do you explain different behaviors for different temperatures?
Well, the deeper physics, I agree, remains to be understood. But the first step is the diagnostic. And what this is telling us, like most of the time, they work. Like I'm showing you I'm highlighting the places where they're in conflict. But I don't want to diminish the fact that most of the time, by which I mean over most of parameter space, the UDW is a good thermometer. It's just that sometimes it's not. And we have checked that in the regimes where it's not, KMS is satisfied, the detector seems to be working. We are still trying to think of deeper reasons why these things might be in conflict. But I think the lesson to be, it's as, I think to some extent, the lesson as with any measuring instrument. There's always limits to how good a measuring instrument is in any given environment. And I think this is showing how good UDW detectors are. It's quite conceivable this is another research problem. Let's look at another kind of detector and see if this thing goes away. I think that's quite possible.
this quantum system in equilibrium has a well-defined temperature, so...
It has a well-defined KMS temperature if it's a field. That's not the same as the ratio of how often the detector gets excited. That's the difference. You should decide who asks.
I want to go right back to the very first, you don't probably need to go there, but you talked about oscillating Unruh-Lewitt detector.
Yeah.
My intuition would be that in that situation, their excitation would not be thermal at all. It would have a resonance at the frequency at which you were.
Yeah, it could.
Double that frequency or something. So, but you plotted it against like temperature, which I don't know what that means in this situation where if you've got a, like, it's really hot at one frequency. But.
Sure. So we did not look at that. We were more interested in asking late time questions. We did look at some of the other things you say, I didn't highlight it, but it's more. The idea is, suppose you want to test the Unruh effect. Well, last I checked, I can't go down to Walmart and buy an eternally accelerating detector. So we have to come to grips with modeling what a real thing could do. Now, shooting it in a line once is difficult, but if you can oscillate it, you've got acceleration all the time in the experiment. That was the logic. And what I wanted to point out here is maybe there are transient or even resonance effects, but in some sense we wanted to be deliberately off resonance to see if this thing would thermalize. And the answer is it does, but it doesn't do it the way that the A over 2 pi prediction says. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I am saying it's something we should have to be aware of.
I guess my point was that in fact you're probably... If the idea was just to see the detector getting excited, probably there's a resonant place where it is far stronger.
Yeah, sure. I'm not disputing that, but that was not the interest here. The interest was to actually sort of avoid the effect you're describing to see if it will generically thermalize, and if so, how. And there are other things in the paper where we don't go to late times and look at others. The reason, I mean, there's more that could be explored, but honestly, the continuum, it's very messy. I mean, it's computationally quite intensive. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be done, but it does mean you can't crank out answers like that.
So with the oscillating detector, I guess the question is, if the goal is to eventually observe the Unruh effect, I know there's also these corrections to decay rates in the cyclotron particle accelerator. So, like, and that, the idea is there is the same thing. You want to move away from this always accelerating group. So, has there been any comparison between where it's more likely to see in these sort of, imagining maybe some mechanical oscillator that's going really quick, like modeling the oscillations you were talking about compared to sort of these decay rates?
I don't entirely know. Chen and Tajima proposed that trajectory with an idea of putting something in a cyclotron. That was the rationale behind that. The emphasis has moved more on testing the Unruh effect sonically with water and with sound and this kind of thing. That's what Silke does. Which actually I think for maybe a number of things in this meeting could be given more thought. Is there some way of modeling these things sonically with phonons instead of photons, for example? It's at least, you know, for indefinite causal order, we're thinking in indefinite causal phonons. Is this possible? I don't know.
So the entanglement shadow is really interesting. I wonder if there's any sort of conceptual lesson to be learned from it. So one question is is the angle calculable from? It must be calculable from some.
Well, it is from the Whiteman function, but not obviously directly. So the Whiteman, you've got three objects now. So the angle is. I mean, naively, you might think it doesn't care where it is, but once you put in two detectors, you've got. A meaningful angle in the Whiteman function, and it's because it's, well, in the particular BTZ case, it's the image sum cares about the angle. It's difficult, at least for me, to see how it comes out in the mode sum. So, yeah, That angle cares about the mass of the black hole. I mean, although I drew one, I mean, I don't want you to think that no matter what the black hole is, it's the same angle. And likewise, the size of this feature, I guess I've got a pointer. The size of this feature right here, this thing surrounding it, is also contingent on the mass of the black hole. I think for a real world Schwarzschild black hole, this is what should be done, but the trouble is you have to do a mode sum to get the entanglement, which is much more intensive. So I think we're gonna try that over the next while, but it won't come out answer. I think the small mass effect probably is peculiar to BTZ, and Schwarzschild may not have that. But from everything we've seen, it looks like Schwarzschild's gonna have a shadow. But its structure and what it depends on, at this point, I would be leery of drawing too many definitive lessons, because the BTZ black hole is obtained by identification in this case. But one other comment about implications. I think this should have firewall-type implications. One problem that, well, we have the only case I know of where someone has looked at what happens to a freely falling detector into a black hole is Hodgkinson and Luco, where they did it for 2+1. And that's it. No one's even done it for Schwarzschild. Keith is working on it right now. It's a very difficult problem because it's a pain in the you-know-where to get the mode sum to converge. And that's painful. And certainly no one's ever, like, what happens if you have entangled detectors and one falls in? I can't break my fingers, but this guy falls in and this guy doesn't, freely falls, right? Freely falling things aren't supposed to see anything. Oh, unless there's firewalls, right? I mean, all of these questions now, I think we have the technology to ask and address them.
Okay, so I think we can stop now because it's lunchtime. So yeah, shall we thank Rob again?